I call the Health and Human Services Finance Work Group to order. We are bound a little bit by schedules this morning. The House meets at 11 o'clock, so we'll need to recess in sufficient time for the House to be into session, and I think the Senate is in session at, is it noon, I believe?
Yeah.
So my plan at this point is that we would recess at that point and then come back here at 1 o'clock to continue our work. But I want to try to get as much done as we can this morning. For members, we created something, kind of an update on the work group. I was having some trouble making clarity on the last Senate offer, so I tried to incorporate that, and as we go through, we'll try to clarify what the Senate responses were. So the item that you have several pages that's called open items is just adding sections, and the way this is done is the shaded areas, I believe, are areas that we have concluded as a working group. And then when there are cases, for example, on the first page at the bottom, there's a box with Senate, and I tried to identify those as some areas where we have some feedback. For example, on this very first section, the Senate, I believe, has an amendment, A51 amendment, that we would be reviewing as a part of this loan forgiveness program area. So, with that, again, probably for the sake of clarity, in the loan forgiveness program, of course, there were aspects for dental and pharmaceutical and some of those kinds of things. It wasn't quite clear to me whether, for example, in the first one where we have the suggestion that they go into the current program, repealing the nursing home loan forgiveness and appropriations and program move to the current loan forgiveness with an amendment A39. It might be best for us to go ahead and just jump to the employee scholarship cost amendment, but I think we'll need to come back and then understand if this relates to any other sections or specifically what section this amendment relates to. So, Senator Bergen, perhaps, first of all, you can position where the A51 amendment affects, and then take us through the A51 amendment. Senator Bergen?
Mr. Chairman, the A51 amendment, and maybe we should get it distributed for all of the members. We did send a copy over to you earlier, but
maybe, Adam.
I'm not sure if everyone has.
I just got it, so I didn't get a chance to distribute it even to our members.
The A51 amendment deals with the employee scholarships that we talked about at one of our more recent meetings. And we've changed it so that it would fund scholarships over a four-year period rather than just the two-year period out of the special revenue account. And the changes that were made are that instead of having an automatic rate increase go into effect for home care, ICFMR, and other group home providers, they would apply if they're interested in providing a scholarship to their employees. And, of course, this would only be available for the employees who are not management or registered nurse or therapists. So these would be people who are in need of a career ladder advancement and who work at least 20 hours per week for the provider. We've deleted all the references to English, learning of English. So people would apply to the department It would still be a rate increase. It would still generate federal funds against the state dollar. The department has helped us to have some criteria in case there would be more applying than there would be funds available. We would be limiting the program to providers who receive at least $500,000 annually in medical assistance payments. They would look at the percentage of employees meeting the scholarship program recipient requirements. They'd look at staff retention rates for the paraprofessionals. Then the funding would flow in a rider form because it would expire after the 4 years is up. And it would be $446,000 in fiscal year 06. And then we would expect it to ramp up because you would have some people coming into the program in the first year who would be continuing in their education the second year. So it ramps up to $983,000 in 07, and then in 08, a little over $1 million, and a little over $1 million in 09. And so we think it works a little better having it be a program that would be in existence for at least the 4 year period. We just recently determined that the administrative costs for the department would be eligible for federal reimbursement also. So the sheet that we have here that shows the funding and the availability of funding would only require 60% of the dollars that are listed on the administrative line. And if the House thinks that this approach is acceptable, we can, by this afternoon, have reworked this amendment to reflect the administrative impact as well.
Mr. Bergman, you indicated that the provider organization would apply then if they're interested. The funding mechanism for this was a rate increase of some sort?
Right. It's a rate add-on.
Now, is that rate add-on, does that get added on if they choose to participate? If they don't choose to participate, would they still have a rate increase, or would it only be the ones that choose to participate?
No, it would only be the ones that choose to participate, and it would be for the scholarship program only that they could use this money.
And Senator Berglund, I don't recall for sure which particular disciplines were eligible, but I don't remember in prior versions that it included social work, medical care, interpreter services. It appeared as though maybe there's an expansion of the fields of study that would be eligible for this. Am I correct in that, or is there?
No, Representative Bradley, those were in our previous versions, and those are also fields that are eligible for scholarships under the Nursing Home Scholarship Program. Those are shortage areas as well, and in terms of providing medical care, those are needed professionals.
Senator Bergman, maybe we just haven't had a chance to have this discussion, but it's not my observation that there's a shortage in the world of social workers, though.
Well, maybe we can hear from people. My understanding is that there has been a shortage of social workers for the long-term care area, that they tend also to be more attracted to hospitals and other professions where there's more kinds of reimbursement. I mean, if that is an issue for you, Representative Bradley, obviously we would be willing to take that out. We'd like to see the scholarship program go ahead, even if that's not included. The majority of the people that use the scholarship program go into nursing, so,
it's in the original version.
But limiting it to nursing is somewhat counterproductive since there are other things that are needed, like physical therapists in home care situations, and there are, you know, other medical professionals, I'm sure, that I can't even think of right now that are in short supply.
And Senator Bergman, I apologize because I just have not had a chance to review the amendment. It looks like it's a complete deletion. The prior mechanism for funding, I think, called for a 0.2% a rate increase. And is that the same? I just didn't catch that in here.
Maybe I can ask Mr. Gill
there it is.
To respond to that question. And also, I guess we have an oral amendment that he forgot to add into the language.
The oral amendment would be on page 1, line 14, after the second comma, insert nursing comma, to clarify that these are nursing is also a field that would be covered by these scholarships. And I'm sorry, Representative Bradley, I didn't catch your question.
Actually, Mr. Autry, I think I answered my own question. I found on page 2 now that the language about the funding is the 0.2% on the medical assistance reimbursement rate. That is the same. The difference apparently is that in this case it's voluntary, depending upon whether or not people sign up for it. And I believe I'm correctly interpreting that.
If
that be the case, then the numbers that we have as far as estimates are concerned, because there would be some sort of a best guess estimate as to how many would choose to participate. The spreadsheet that we have, is that sort of the best estimates now of how much money would be required and how much money would be spent based on expected participation rates then?
Yes, Bradley, and it does track with the rider. Although, as I said, since this spreadsheet was put together, we have discovered that the administrative costs, the cost of administering the program would be eligible for federal reimbursement also, and so we would get 40% federal dollars, so the numbers that would be needed would be 60% of what are shown on this sheet.
And Senator Bergman, in that regard, I'm not sure I can tell by the spreadsheet whether it's a kind of a balance sheet that shows expected additional income from that 0.2, or if this is just the amount of cost that there would be. It looks like it's primarily the amount of cost that there would be. Is there a corresponding estimate as to what the income would be? If it does it match this?
It would. The scholarship dollars themselves would draw federal funding also, because it would be in the rates.
And
that's one of the reasons we're using this mechanism, so we can, you know, get more for less, as you tell us.
But what I'm looking to is, I can't necessarily tell from this spreadsheet, Senator Bergen, whether it balances, whether the expected incomes coming from that rate increase for those that will volunteer is sufficient to cover this expected expenses. That's my question.
Well, in response to the first question, if you look at the line that says state share of scholarship dollars with the federal revenue, it would double. The 0.2 of a percent rate increase is what the nursing homes are using for their scholarship program. It's been in existence for, 8 years maybe? 4 years? 4 years, we haven't heard any complaints that it doesn't work or that the amount of the rate increase isn't enough. Obviously, you know, not all employees that work in one of these institutions are either interested in or going to receive a scholarship. And under this proposal, you know, if an organization isn't interested in making that available, they wouldn't apply.
Well, Senator Berger, am I reading it right that this is an additional two-tenths to fund these expanded scholarship options?
Yes.
Okay. Now, that's
and
what
it's dedicated for that purpose.
Right. My question was, what is the income flow predicted from that additional two-tenths, given the voluntary status? Do we have any estimates from either finance or DHS on what the expected income flow looks like? Because I think this is the spending side of it.
Mr. Hill? Mr. Chair, Bob Held from the Department of Human Services. The facilities or the programs that the providers that apply for this would receive increases the first year of up to 0.2%, and they would have discretion as to who they give scholarships to. So there would be no requirement on their part to give a scholarship to everybody who comes and asks for one, and hence be at risk for spending any amount beyond what they're actually realizing in the rate adjustment. In subsequent years, this gives the department the authority to adjust the rate adjustment that is being given to those programs based on their actual scholarship giving experience, so that if they're in fact providing more in scholarships and we have money available, we would be able to give them an increase to that rate. If they're doing scholarships but not spending as much, then we would give them a little bit less. But overall, from the perspective of that provider, they would be able to realize revenues and expenses that they could get into balance.
So, Mr. Hill, maybe that's an angle that I hadn't quite understood. Are you telling me that the income that's provided from the rate increase stays within that particular facility then to be used for scholarships for their employees specific, just that right in that own their own facility?
Mr. Chair, yes, because the requirement is in here that the employee has to work at least 20 hours a week for that provider.
And then, Mr. Hale, does that mean that the facility has the authority to sort of manage within that budget, that they can only allocate as much as is available from whatever rate that they're currently paying?
Mr. Chair, yes, they would be able to manage that.
Okay. Are there any further questions from members?
Mr. Chairman,
Senator Berger,
if I can just add, and so not only is it a career ladders program, but it is also a longevity incentive, because you have to continue working for the provider who receives the rate increase and gives the scholarships to continue getting the scholarship while you're going through your coursework.
And maybe, Mr. Held, you can help just put these things in a proper perspective. We already have a scholarship program for apparently, and I've forgotten which, but certain career ladders. Can you differentiate where we currently are versus the expansion that this amendment would provide?
Mr. Chair, the scholarship program that we currently have only operates in nursing facilities. And it's only in facilities that report to us that they have spent money on scholarships, and then that money is built into their rate based on their actual resident days, so that they recover fully the amount of money that they have spent. But it only applies to people working in nursing homes, and it's only nursing homes that get that rate adjustment. This scholarship program would be in the whole list of other service providers under the home and community-based waivers and so forth. And you know what? I think I lost track of your question.
You were helpful, because I thought about that other dimension. But mine was the next step of that is the additional career ladders that are available under this expansion.
Okay, sorry about that, Mr. Chair.
I'm sorry, and what are the current career ladders?
And under the existing program, it's for a student in any program that would advance them within the facility or within a long-term care career. And this has that same language in it. They both have language that refers to the social workers and the interpreter services and so forth. I believe that language is also in the nursing home scholarship program. But basically, we would instruct the providers that it has to be a program that would advance them within that provider employment or within a career in long-term care, and that includes interpreter services or social work. We would, under the current program and language, we would not restrict it to just nursing or those listed items. It would be any course of study that would advance the person in long-term care would be an eligible course of study.
Thank you. Representative Abler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A couple ideas. This
Thank you for your testimony. I think that included questions to you.
And Senator, I think that certainly qualifies as a commendable idea. I have a couple of concerns, and I like the idea, and I think to support the workers in trying to move and retain them is a great idea. I think it's back to the source of the money, and it's ironic that the very people who are giving the money, in this case, over $3 million, are most of them are prohibited from using any of it. I think that's the nurses can't, registered nurses can't take any of this money and advance themselves, even though it's money that they themselves paid in, and that's the challenge we're all under, I realize.
Well, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Berglund, to that point.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman and Representative Abler, the whole idea of it is that those who are working in nursing want more nurses, and especially in these areas of long-term care where they're paid much less and there's much less attraction to be in nursing or other medical professions in the long-term care area. And so I think that's why, you know, creating a scholarship program for these low-income people, which we're taking out of the higher ed portion of the bill with this proposal, we'd be adding something here for low-income people. It would generate federal funds. It would create a career ladder, provide incentives for retention of staff. And most of these people end up working in these professional careers, nursing or interpreter services in long-term care. And so it's kind of a growing of your own. And I think, you know, I think the nurses that pay the fee in would like to see this kind of a mechanism to create more nurses and other professionals working in long-term care.
Mr. Deber.
Yeah, and I appreciate that, and that's why I like the idea of it. I'm just, and what you're saying is true, although, it, as Mr. Held just said, they could take a course on accounting and be a better clerk, or they could be a better, the custodial staff could take some, there's any amount of, there's no limit on what kind of course they could take. It doesn't have to lead toward a nursing degree, and it doesn't have to lead toward any advancement of their particular skill, except that they might move into an administrator. They might take some courses on leadership. No. Might take, well, according to what we were just told, they would approve a course on any topic. If this doesn't, just the way it's written, and maybe if you want to make it so that they're moving toward being a nurse or being a longer-term worker there to support the nurses, that's, I'm just pointing out maybe it's a policy gap in the language.
Well, Representative Abler, it isn't limited to the examples that are given in the bill, but it is... it is expected that you would become a professional health care provider in the long-term care area. The idea isn't that you become an accountant. The idea is you become a nurse or you become a physical therapist or a medication monitor or something that requires additional education to move up the ladder. And I know that's how the other scholarship program is administered as well, so.
Well, that's true.
Well, Madam Chair,
this maybe the
other healthcare fields.
But maybe it's on pages. It's on lines 10 through following there. A course of study that's expected to lead to career advancement with the provider. Well, career advancement with the provider is a very vague term. That's my point. Or in the field of long-term care, it doesn't mean you couldn't be moving to administration from being in clerical or going from hands-on care as some kind of an assistant into another personal advancement of some other kind. I don't think that's a bad thing. But I just point out that it's very broadly written and doesn't include that people would stay in the healthcare provision role and they're at the ground floor and move from an intake position to be a CNA or whatever they might move up into. But that's my point. And so just as we work through this, I just thought you should know my thoughts. And maybe you do want to allow nurses to take advantage of some of this to retain them in that niche. since it's their money to start with. If you had general fund money, I think we could be more stringent on it, what we could suggest, but here we are. And maybe we want some of these nurses to move into admissions, positions of DON and so on. So.
That's all my thoughts. Representative Abler, Mr. Chairman, Representative Abler, the other part that we had using this money was for nurses to become educators, to get that advanced education they need to become a healthcare educator. And so that does give nurses an opportunity to get more education as well. That's not in this amendment. It's in other language that's a part of this total loan forgiveness program package.
Further discussion? I'm trying to decide whether I should invite any. I think our time is a little bit short, but let me at least ask if there is anyone, given the fact that this is some new language here based on sort of the a concept that was around, but is there anyone that wishes to make any comment to the working group regarding this proposal? Welcome to the committee, and please introduce yourself for the record.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Mary Jo George with the Minnesota Nurses Association. And we do want to be on record that we do support this proposal. It is true that we have been frustrated that the funds in the overture or the over expenditure or the over collection of nurse licensure fees has been adding up in the Board of Nursing. But it is our understanding that the money has gone to general deficit funding reduction, and it is our preference that we would actually put that back into nursing. Now, of course, if it was an ideal world, we'd like it to just all go to nursing, but we recognize that this program is broader than that, and we are willing to accept that. We are thankful for the other proposals that address the nurse educator shortage, which the you guys have accepted that, and I think that is important too. We see these as a multi-pronged strategy to addressing the nurse shortage. And I know the board might disagree and would prefer to keep the money within their own ranks, but I'm not sure that that is an option on the table right now. So we would like to just stress that we think these are excellent programs to get people involved in nursing. Thank you.
If I may ask just one, I don't know if you know or if somebody from the Board of Nursing would have to deal with this, but the first biennium is a little lighter in terms of expenses because of probably start point or something, I assume. Then the next biennium we begin to see what looks like $978, almost a million-dollar investment a year. Have we looked at the structural situation in those years? Are we, when I say structural, I mean year by year? Are the revenues sufficient to cover this without seeing a year by year deficit, and so we don't see a long range problem as far as the fund is concerned?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, it was my understanding that we could meet the outlay without having to raise revenues. I haven't compared this to the last tracking sheet that we had, so perhaps David Godfrey could provide some assistance on that. But the last proposal that was on the table, we did have a $6 million surplus going out to 07. And so my understanding is this would be within that budget. I think the policy issue that probably hasn't been addressed that people keep struggling with is how much money should we keep as a reserve for these boards? And I don't believe that we have actually come to that conclusion because what we've done is we've zeroed out these funds in the past. In the last round of budget deficit reductions, we've zeroed them out. So I do believe the boards do have concerns that they feel they need perhaps some reserve, but I don't believe we've actually weighed in and made decisions on that.
Well, maybe if I could just make a request. One time we had a spreadsheet, but it was a collected because there's other places that are affecting that fund as well. Those is in this, and I think it'd be nice to have an updated spreadsheet to see. Mr. Godfrey, do you have a comment to this?
Yes, Mr. Chair, members. I just a little background in this, and I will prepare that spreadsheet for you showing what the balance of the Board of Nursing is with this new proposal. But I can tell you that the accumulated balance for the Board of Nursing special revenue account by the end of the first biennium would be $6 million. And then going beyond into 08-09, the spreadsheet that you were referring to, Mr. Chair, showed that the remaining balance after all of the proposals in both the in the Senate bill are paid for, the remaining balance in that account would be $1.470 million. What this amendment does is appropriate an additional $1.4 million from the Board of Nursing account, bringing the accumulated balance in that account by the end of 09 to $70,000, and that's with the assumption that every proposal in the Senate bill would pass. So it does balance, albeit a small amount, by the end of 09.
I'm sorry, Mr. Godfrey, I wasn't necessarily fully tracking. Is it, okay, does it balance within that year? I mean, I understand that there's sufficient surplus to carry us over those 4 years. Mm-hmm. But in the fourth year, what is the structural situation as far as are we spending more in that fourth year than with all those accumulated than we have in the income for that year?
Mr. Chair, I'll have to get back to you on that.
Okay, that's fair. Sure, sure. Welcome to the committee. I think we have someone else, too, that wants to testify. So,
Nelson, thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the working group. I'm Bruce Nelson with ARM, and I want to speak in favor of the proposal. We look at, number one, a turnover which varies among providers, but typically around 50% of people, direct support professionals in our field, and often that's about 50%, another 50% of those just in the first year of employment. We believe this, as Ms. George said, is part of a multifaceted approach to retention and building career ladders for people, and would help, along with other measures that we're taking in the industry and along with ECOLA, of course, would help in encouraging people to build careers, to stay in the field, even though there is still low pay. I just conferred with Mr. Bangsberg from the Home Care Association, and he too is interested in looking at this proposal. It's relatively new to him in looking at it, but as, again, one of the tools we can use to retain people in the field.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. My name is Shirley Breck, and I'm the Executive Director of the Board of Nursing. First of all, thanks to Mr. Godfrey. I was back here doing the math also and came up with $74,000, so I'd like to talk to you a little bit about the math, but you know, that's what the balance would be if all of the proposals are funded. And that, of course, assumes that the income is going to, the revenue will continue to be what it is. I think that what I would tell you is that the board did take a position on the proposal for the Center for Nursing and did support it. The board did, of course, take a position on the request for the increased appropriation to fund the vacancies that we currently have. The board did not take a position on the funding for scholarship or loan forgiveness. I would call attention to the fact, and I know I'm doing this at the risk of the wrath of one of my colleagues, that is the executive director of the Board of Social Work, but I would like to call attention to the committee that the Board of Social Work, social workers are getting a fee reduction with the surplus funds that they have, and yet with the scholarship fund the way that it is, funded by the special revenue fund and fees from nurse licensure fees, would be funding education for social workers and others. I would call your attention to that fact that for nurses, the board had proposed a fee reduction. I understand that the House language does support or provide for us to do that because there was the recognition that there was an overcollection of fees due to some unforeseen revenues, and the intent was to give it back to the nurses. So if the committee would you know, just consider that social workers are getting some of their fees reduced, nurses that will be at risk with the amount of spending.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Aber.
Ms. Beckman.
There might be a question here. Representative Aber.
The question was brought up, and maybe you can comment on it. How much do you need to keep in your reserve to keep flush? I understand that's for purpose of litigation and defense and so on. Is there a magic number? Is 10% a number that people like, 20% of your budget? Can you comment, please?
Mr. Chair, Representative Abler, that's a very good question. As you know, we do have to fund the costs of litigation with the Attorney General's office and with the Office of Administrative Hearings. The Board of Nursing, unlike a couple of the other boards, does seldom go to a full contested case hearing, and so our costs in that area have been really very limited compared to what we might expect from some of the other boards. That does not mean that that same thing could not happen to us. It just has not historically been that way. Some of those contested case hearings have costed other boards in excess of $1 million. And so if that were to occur, we would draw from the special revenue fund, then we would have to raise licensure fees to replace those dollars in the special revenue fund regarding that. So to answer your question about what kind of a reserve that would be appropriate to retain, the board's operating expenses right now are generally in a little over about $3.5 million. So, you know, we've always said that to be fiscally responsible, to maintain in reserve sufficient funds to cover 1 year's operating expenses would meet those. But we've never been tested with it and had to, you know, use that rationale.
Thank you.
Senator Lori.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Is there something we should consider looking at percentages of the fee compared to the salaries that a social worker and a nurse would get? Should we be thinking about that as you talk about the scholarship funding social workers but coming out of the reserve for nurses? Is there any relationship we should think about? For instance, has the fee for social workers been higher based on their income, and the fee for nurses not as high?
Mr. Chair, Senator Lori, that's a difficult question to answer. What I can tell you is that the licensure renewal fee for nurses, both RNs and LPNs, the board does not differentiate between the two levels of practitioners, although certainly there is a difference in their salaries, is $85 every 2 years. Compared to social work, which I believe is somewhere in the area of $225 a year. So the Board of Nursing, the renewal fee for nurses is lower than any of the other health-regulated licensees, with the exception of dental assistants and pharmacy technicians, who, as you recognize, would have certainly less of an income. Certainly the reason for that is just sheer volume. The Board of Nursing licenses about 92,000 nurses. Contrast that with the next largest board would be just under 20,000, and that's the Board of Medical Practice. So they're just, you know, it is volume that certainly does add to contribute to that. I'm sorry. I hope I answered your question. Maybe I did not. I was trying to show you a comparison of that. The proposed reduction had been to reduce the fee by $10 to $75 every 2 years.
Thank you.
Senator Bergman.
Mr. Chairman, there really is no standard for the boards in terms of a reserve for any of them. As far as I know. And the other comment I wanted to make is that, you know, if the Board of Nursing would feel more comfortable just having this proposal cover nursing, we could take the fee and we could apply it to both scholarship programs for the nurses and then take the general fund money that we have for the others. Of course, you know, that would mean we'd have to take this amendment back to the drawing table, and it might just be easier to go with it the way it is, but The general fund is providing nursing scholarships today that are not paid for out of the Board of Nursing, and that is my point here.
Any further discussion? Thank you for your testimony.
Mr. Chairman, my name is John Husted. I am testifying on behalf of my own association, the Minnesota Health and Housing Alliance. And I think that both chairs are aware that we have been strong supporters of the nurse scholarship program in the nursing home, and this does include home and community-based services for the elderly, and we're very much in support of funding these scholarships. Nurses, you know, LPNs are a particular concern for nursing homes for anybody who's involved in the care of the elderly for long-term care. So I just wanted to go on record and say we do strongly support this.
Excuse me, would you explain to me, as I'm still frankly struggling a little bit with this rate increase and about sort of who actually pays the rate increase? How does this program on the side of creating revenue affect nursing homes, for example?
Well, I think this will not affect nursing homes. The nursing home program, we have members, you know, that provide community-based services as well as nursing home members. So that's kind of the members I'm testifying on behalf. The scholarship program for nursing homes is based on the amount of money that is spent on scholarships and then reimbursed, you know, at cost, really. In this case, there would be a different funding mechanism.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, I probably should have asked. Why don't we try it instead for home health care, since that's kind of that would be a sort of a new entry, I think, with this proposal. How would it affect them, then? Can you speak at all to representing them?
I do have one question on the funding mechanism myself. And my understanding is here that the funds come from the surplus Board of Nursing surplus, and it goes to the department based on the appropriations in the rider, and then the money is conveyed to the providers on the basis of a rate increase.
Right.
And so it's just a mechanism to get money to the provider. It's not
it's finally beginning to dawn on me, I think, that it's not a rate increase to the providers. It's a rate increase in what they're paid, from
exactly.
There. Okay. Thank you. That helps. I think we have time for about one more. I hope I don't see anybody else that wishes to, because I think we're going to need to run fairly quickly.
Mr. Chairman and members, quite quickly. I'm Iris Freeman with Advocacy Strategy, and I'm speaking for the Alzheimer's Association. The Alzheimer's Association has taken a position in strong favor of extending the capacity of home and community-based services workers to the scholarship program. We have long supported the scholarship program for nursing home workers. We are very firm supporters of balancing long-term care to enable people to receive care in their homes and communities whenever possible. And so we, among other seniors organizations, hope that the right balance can be struck here so that this scholarship opportunity will be so extended.
Thank you. Okay. All right. I think at this point, given a little travel time here, that we'll recess until 1 o'clock this afternoon. I'll call our meeting back to order.
I have a different amendment, a little tweaking.
Okay. We were working on our working group, and I do want to come back to that, but I did think that it would be timely at this point, and I realize this is contingency planning, but we also have to face reality that if we are unable to conclude budget, then there is a potential for shutdown. There were announcements made yesterday. I had a chance to visit with the commissioners and asked if they could join us for sort of a brief breakdown. I think from time to time there's confusion about what would happen or what would not happen with a potential shutdown. So if I can call forward, first of all, I think I'd call both of you at the same time. Okay. Commissioner Mannick and Commissioner Goodnow, welcome to the committee. And You can then choose, even if you'd like, who would begin.
Gee, thanks. My name is Kevin Goodnow. I'm the Commissioner of Human Services for the state of Minnesota.
And we're delighted to have you.
Well, Mr. Chairman,
at this point,
members, I'm delighted to be here. What the chairman asked me to do is just talk briefly about the shutdown and shutdown preparations for the Department of Human Services and what the potential impacts of that may be. And the first thing I want to mention is the fact that the shutdown planning and where we're heading is still very fluid. The state has never faced a shutdown before. We've planned for it before, but we've actually never implemented a shutdown before. What we've been mandated to do is identify critical services to preserve the health and safety of the people that we serve and the people of Minnesota. In doing that, the governor announced and released a list of things yesterday that would be what we consider the functions and the programs that we consider critical to the health and safety of individuals. But in that same list, it basically stated that the staff and operating expenses minimally necessary to continue to secure and support these operations are what would be authorized during a shutdown. So once we've identified the functions, the next step is to identify the individuals that we need in order to minimally carry out those functions in those areas. So you might look at that whole list and say, well, gee, it looks like everything that you do is critical. But there's subparts of what we do within those functions that we're identifying as critical or identifying as non-critical. And I'll just mention a few of them that we've identified as critical, identify some that we've identified as non-critical, and then just talk about where we go from here. Some of the critical services are our direct care services that we provide to people that are in our state-operated services. These are direct care workers providing services to people who are mentally ill and also with regard to our people who are civilly committed to us in various ways, including sex offenders. What it doesn't necessarily include in state-operated services are services that are not critical to the direct care being provided. In other words, maintenance type of work may or may not be critical depending upon what the maintenance requirements are. Lawn mowing, those sort of things would necessarily fall into that critical category. And I should say we're still in the process of identifying individuals who will be impacted and some of the job classifications that would be impacted. Also, the one area not listed as non-critical are state-operated services, community clinics. The dental clinics, for example, in Cambridge, Faribault, and Fergus Falls would not be deemed critical. Continued eligibility in our health care programs would be deemed to be critical, but the enrollment process to enroll new enrollees in the Minnesota Care Program that's operated by the state would not be deemed critical. Making sure that people on our programs with cash assistance, child care assistance, and food assistance for children and families would be deemed to be critical. The receipt and disbursement of child support payments would be deemed to be critical. Payment to certain providers would be deemed to be critical, but I need to say payment to other providers would deem not to be critical. So we made the assessment of what services are deemed to be critical and also what providers that it's critical for them to receive state payments in order to continue functioning, and we've made judgment calls in those areas. Minnesota care premium processing is considered to be critical. Our HIV/AIDS health care program is considered to be critical. And again, in those areas that I've talked about, when I say critical, we're still talking about the minimal staff and operating expenses necessary to further those programs and those functions. And again, we're making our best estimate and as to how we can manage that. And this will be in flux. I mean, we are putting, I would say that risk goes up every day that we go into a shutdown. The risk of things, delays, the risk of not receiving services, of receiving needed services will go up for these individuals. And so part of what we need to do is identify who we need to do the critical services, but we also need to figure out and identify the structure within the agency as how we manage things from a day-to-day operation during a shutdown to make sure that all the critical services are being provided. Some other services that were deemed non-critical, and I've mentioned a couple already, but some other ones we would not have any administrative fair hearings during a shutdown. That will either result in one of two things. People that were denied benefits may not receive it, or people that were receiving benefits improperly may continue to receive those. Certain grants to entities, including counties and nonprofits, would not be sent out or administered. Training to counties would be suspended. Helplines to everyone except clients would be deemed non-critical, and we're still figuring out exactly to what level we man those. But we have helplines and information lines both for counties and providers. Those will not be deemed critical. We have systems that would deem to be non-critical, but as long as the system and the functions are continuing to operate, we'll let them operate. But if, for example, the website that has the eDoc system goes down, we would deem that ramping it back up and fixing and getting the program going would not be critical. And that would be the same for the child support online, which is gives people information about the child, the status of the child support payments and stuff. Adoption services, people will see delays in their adoption services and if they're in the process of adopting children, both in state custody and in international children. And also the SRB hearings, the special review boards for people who are civilly committed, they will not be heard during a shutdown either. And those are the SRB hearings, are the hearings that you need to hold in order to release people from civil commitment. Those are just examples of both critical and non-critical that we've identified so far. As I said before, and I'm going to reiterate, it's a fluid process right now. It's an uncertain process. And the bottom line is that if we go into a shutdown mode, the risk of people not receiving needed services does go up. As far as employees impacted in my agency, in Department of Human Services, and I just need to say the numbers that were used in the press conference yesterday and the numbers that I'm going to give you today are actual individuals' numbers, the number of individuals rather than the number of FTEs or the number of equivalent dollar amounts. There's a number of different ways to count employees. But the actual number of individuals that we have working for our agency at this time is about 6,800. Of those, it breaks down approximately about 1,900 to central office and about 4,900 to state-operated services. Of those, just over 4,000 were deemed to be critical. Of the critical people, 3,800 of them are in state-operated services, and about just over 200 are identified in central office. So the non-critical would be make up about 1,600 in the central office and about 1,100 people in state-operated services. With that, Mr. Chairman, that I would stand for any questions that you may have about where we're at within this process. Oh, by the way, the other thing, we are in the process, and what I've been trying to do right along as information becomes available and is made public is to keep my employees informed of what's happening. And we do have a list, a number of things that notices that will be sent out, and not only to our employees, any potential furloughs or layoffs that would take place, notices would be sent out the last week of June. But we are also sending out notices to clients in our different various programs, to vendors, and to counties and other affected parties, just to let them know what's going on and providing them proper notice. To the extent that, you know, to the extent the notices go out, we will be incurring a cost of about $100,000 related to sending out notices. And that will be a cost we incur prior to the end of this month.
Commissioner, I don't know if it what happens in Department of Human Services, but there are other areas when I've heard some reviews of the broader view of any potential shutdown. But, in fact, the state of Minnesota would incur considerable costs and not savings. I mean, intuitively, one might think that a shutdown is going to save. From just the Department of Human Services point of view, what's the kind of the net fiscal impact?
Mr. Chairman, I have to apologize. I don't have the breakdown specific to the agency as to what the impact would be. We would incur, depends on how far along you go into shutdown and what the judge actually allows to be included as critical. For example, we're in the process of building a new building. And we've added that to the list of what is critical because it would have a dramatic impact on costs if we were to discontinue that operation and have to close down that building site. If that's not deemed critical, that has major implications with regard to contract penalties with the contractor, with readying the site for safety purposes for being shut down, and for also with delay for us getting into the building so we'd have duplicate leasing costs. And I don't have the exact numbers on that. Outside of that, the issue of the first 2 weeks that we're in a furlough situation, basically, we are still incurring payroll and benefit costs for those employees because they are still employees. In some cases, people don't have built-up vacation, so there are employees that will not receive a paycheck for the time off if they don't have any vacation built up. I know on a statewide level, out of the 15,000-plus employees that are identified for being in this as non-critical, about 700 of them have no accrued vacation time, and that accrued vacation time is used up by about 350 people each day as they go into the situation. So it starts adding up rather quickly as far as the number of employees that are directly impacted by this. If it goes beyond the two-week period, then we're in a situation where we have to do layoffs, and that triggers bumping rights within our agencies. And so that there'll be a huge changeover, and we're actually figuring out how to manage that if that situation takes place as well. At that point, we have severance costs related to paying for accrued vacation time, paying for sick leave. There's some other benefits that accrue to employees in that situation as well. I know the statewide costs are in the hundreds of millions of dollars that could be incurred with those layoffs. So that's it kind of gives you a perspective. There is, as far as we can tell, there's no cost savings associated with this. Matter of fact, there are costs that are associated to it with it. And quite frankly, right now, there's a lot of lost opportunity costs because we have so many people focused on shutdown planning that it's taking away from other functions that we should be doing.
Any questions, members?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Babler.
Oh, this is handout. Is that part of your presentation to this big grant?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Babler, I haven't handed anything out.
All right, thank you.
I think that we found that for members. It's kind of a list of some of the contracts, that kind of thing.
Okay, thanks.
Senator.
Thank you,
Hunter.
Mr. Chairman. Commissioner, I want to offer you some encouragement. First of all, it looks like you're doing a good job in terms of preparing for a shutdown. So my encouragement is for you to be very frank, I don't see any urgency from any of the parties in these negotiations to get them done. I know Senator Johnson had to go out to the East Coast, and hopefully he'll be back soon. The governor is apparently today going around the state discussing the potential shutdown. The Senate Republicans have come up with more offers than the House Republicans have. So we all have an ability to share in this potential shutdown. I guess my frustration comes from being out at a meeting of state government officials last week and seeing leadership in other states, Connecticut, and Washington State and Nevada, getting together and the leaders from the three groups, and they're divided politically also, the governor and the two leaders from the House and the Senate sitting down and spending a long period of time. These issues aren't going to change any in the next 2 months. And I would encourage you to get the governor, and we certainly have a responsibility to get our legislative leaders to sit down and get this job done. The issues are clear. What needs to be done is compromise, and I'll say in a positive sense, I think the governor showed some leadership and compromise on the cigarette tax. I know Senator Berglund has shown some leadership and compromise in this particular area, but I'm on a bipartisan basis or tripartisan basis or whatever it is, fed up with our inability to have the numbers so we can work in this conference committee in getting this resolved. So I encourage you to encourage the administration. I will encourage as much as I can Senate and House people I know. But it's unfortunate you have to do this. Other states aren't facing this. And they've got differing political leadership also.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Hottinger, I appreciate the comments, especially with regard to how we have to work together to find a solution. I had an employee meeting at one of my employee sites in the city in St. Paul a couple days ago. And as you can imagine, the shutdown weighs on everybody's mind, especially for people. A lot of people have mortgages and families and kids to support. And how are they going to do that in a situation like this? And how do you plan for that into the future when there's things aren't being done? So from my perspective, yes, I will encourage the governor to come to the table and negotiate in earnest, but it takes more than one person to be interested in reaching a deal. We need to have all the parties at the table. But my bottom line is that for the people that we serve in the Department of Human Services, the potential risk to them with the shutdown is dramatic. And we are going to manage to the best of our ability to make sure and minimize any negative consequences to the most vulnerable people in the state. But there are no guarantees in this process because we've never been through this process before. And so I just can't emphasize enough how critical it is for everybody to get the job done, and so we can avoid the shutdown in the future, the shutdown at the end of the month.
Mr. Chairman.
Where am I hearing from? Oh, Santa Corn.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just would like to weigh in on from the Republican side and say thank you to Senator Hottinger. His words are always very encouraging and very positive, and I miss him as Majority Leader. He always had a very calm way of about doing things, and I would say that I'm willing to do whatever it's going to take too. I'm willing to take the tough votes that we need to take and to move this forward. I had a parade last Sunday, and people are not talking about any specific issues. They just they're puzzled that 201 adults cannot compromise or come to an agreement to get something done. You know, and some people on the far right or on the far left might say, oh my goodness, compromise is a bad word. No, we compromise every day of our lives, folks. And we've got to get the work done here. And I guess any way that I can be of any assistance to the leaders or anything, you know, I'm always here. Just ask me for my cell phone number, and I'm willing to help. But I sure hope we can get this done. It's actually kind of embarrassing. I'm kind of embarrassed that we can't get this work done. And I want to thank the commissioner. He always, I think you're doing a stand-up job. I thank you for your work. And I'm confident, you know, I'm the eternal optimist. I'm confident that we'll be able to get this figured out. And, you know, the campaigns are not until next year, so let's not even worry about the campaigns. Let's just do the people's work. So I thank you, Mr. Chairman, for letting me express my opinion.
Thank you. And, Commissioner, I do think, having reviewed this before and now again at this moment, that you and your department have done a good job in trying to minimize the impact. But on the other hand, I don't want to sit here and have us feel like, well, it doesn't make any difference. There's 15,700 employees for whom it's going to make a very strong difference. There's going to be people walking in to sign up for Minnesota Care for whom it will make a very strong difference. There are people depending on the grants that are not going to be able to be funded for whom it's going to make a strong difference. I think up and down the line, we probably don't even know yet, even as diligent as your department has been, what the consequences are going to be. I think that some providers are going to be at risk in terms of payment timings or payments period. So even though I think, and I know the theme was very supportive, and I appreciate that, and I agree, but on the other hand, I don't want us to kid ourselves that it doesn't make any difference. It makes a big difference. We still got some days left here, and it would be better for everybody if you didn't have to follow through with your plan.
Appreciate that, Mr. Chair. And most of you have worked with me for a number of years, and I don't get nervous or rattled about things very often, but I would say my nervousness level on this is very high. And I think it's all politics aside, if we go beyond June 30th, it's a very serious thing that we're doing.
Thank you. Mr. Mandenbeck, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I appreciate the opportunity to be here and to talk about the Minnesota Department of Health. I want to suggest that Commissioner Goodnow laid out the issue very beautifully on where we are today. As far as the Health Department is concerned, you know that our mission is to protect, maintain, and improve the health of Minnesotans. We also have the tentative list of functions that we believe are critical to maintaining the health of people, particularly in light of 9/11 versus the last time when the preparation was made. We had to look at it with a little bit of a different view this time. We very much are considering it critical to continue to investigate and respond to disease outbreaks, investigate the complaints in healthcare facilities, to inspect municipal water systems. We believe that in light of 9/11, that's something that we cannot ignore. We will also, and have proposed, critical for inspecting restaurants. again, as Commissioner Goodnow has said, any sense that this is business as usual is not accurate. These functions would be carried on by a skeletal staff. We have approximately 1,400 employees. We would look to keep about 200 for these functions. So to say that we're going to be doing in the midst of a shutdown what we do on a normal day is not accurate at all. I don't know that we know the consequences to the state totally. For example, in the area of facility complaints, healthcare facility complaints, we would triage those. We would take the most serious as the point of investigation. We would do the similar sort of thing with restaurants. If there is an issue that needs to be, that rises to the attention, that's where we would go. If, in fact, there is no issue, staff could continue to do some of the inspections, but as soon as there is something that rises to the surface, that then stops the normal inspection and they deal with the issue at hand. We will not be granting new health occupation licenses. We would do renewal, but we would not be able to do any new health occupation renewal. There are some things that would not continue. Providing the grant funding that helps local public health departments meet the health needs of their communities, that would stop. That's approximately $22 million that goes out to our local people. We would not be providing the grant funding to community organizations that work to reduce disparities. We have 57 of our grantees in the minority populations. That would stop. We would not respond to environmental health hazards such as cleaning up meth labs or asbestos, lead, or indoor air. We would not respond to consumer complaints regarding their HMO. In the area of newborn screening, we would be doing the testing for newborn screening because that is time sensitive in terms of those children, but we would not be able to do any follow-up for that screening. We would not be able to and would not maintain our website. We receive about 11,000 hits a day on that website for general information regarding health issues for the people in the state of Minnesota and the providers. We would not provide technical assistance or consultation for providers or industry or units of government on health issues or patient care regulatory requirements. That would all stop. I think that when we try and estimate what the impact is actually going to be, I don't know that we know that. Public health is about preventing situations before they occur, and we won't know. We really won't know until we actually get to this point, look back and see what the consequences are. We are committed to carry on the very critical functions for maintaining the health and safety of the citizens of our state. We have a very dedicated group of people at the health department, and I certainly hope with Commissioner Goodnow that this whole situation can be avoided. Our employees are very nervous. We're in the process at this point of identifying people who would continue these critical functions. So they're not sure whether they're in or out, even though the critical functions are out there. They're not sure if they're an individual who stays or doesn't stay. And again, to reiterate what Commissioner Goodnow said, he who has a mortgage payment and children and those issues, most people are working, they need a paycheck. And it becomes a very stressful time for employees as they're dealing with this. Just so that you know, we are in the process of communicating with our grantees, our contractors, and our vendors to let them know how they would be affected in the event of a shutdown. We did prepare a fact sheet for you that I believe you have at your place, just summarizing basically information that I have. And Mr. Chairman, committee, I would stand for questions.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Coyne.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Commissioner, you didn't mention anything about death certificates. Would that be a disruption in that area at all?
We have put the vital statistics on our list of critical services. We'll have to see if the court agrees.
Okay. Thank you.
You. Mr. Mendick, I just wondered, I've been asked, surely this would be the time that nursing homes would not have surveys?
Well, actually, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, actually, we determined that that was a critical function in terms of maintaining the care for our residents. Again, we'll see whether the court agrees.
So for all those of you who are getting those false hopes up, you just heard the news.
That would be true.
Coming on.
Yeah. And Commissioner Mendick, you have in here responding to disease breakout, and I mean, none of us want to anticipate anything, but I mean, sometimes when we're doing our disaster planning, we're disaster planning for major, major kind of effects. If and hopefully not to happen, but if something did, how would you sort of muster the resources under these circumstances to respond?
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, that is one of the things that we are looking at in terms of what ability we would have. There is the school of thought that we are responsible for maintaining that critical function, which would give us, we would argue, the ability then to make that critical function happen. So worst case scenario, if there is a shutdown, July 5th, there's a major tornado or a major outbreak, we have to maintain the critical function associated, and we would then judge that we have the ability to pull people back to accomplish that function.
Thank you. Any further discussion, members? Seeing none, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee.
Members, if we could go back to the several-page stapled item that was called HHS Work Group 2005 Special Session, June 16th, open items. And with your indulgence, what I would like to do is to walk through and make sure that our inventory is correct. Now, this is, again, I don't mean that this is all that we've worked on as a work group. These were the items that were open items at the time when this was originally done, I think June 10th. Subsequent to that, the Senate had made a counteroffer, and I've tried to catch those as well. So it would be my intention to sort of walk through this, confirm where we are, and then we can proceed later on with any kind of follow-up. In that respect, then, in the first italicized area, we have the loan forgiveness. I believe we have a pending amendment, A39. We had suggested, I believe the House in the bold italicized, it said accept. It wasn't mentioned, but I'm assuming that this is an item where we do have agreement. It's fairly complicated because there were several groups within it. We were repealing the language in the Senate. We had the amendment that did that, and then it would be appropriated under our domain. But I, the reason I didn't shade that is I just wanted to confirm today, and perhaps Senator Bergman, if you can, in your mind, is this an item that we've closed on and accepted?
Representative Bradley, we believe that both the proposal that we had for nurse loan educators and the scholarship program were kind of tied to repeal of the language in the higher education bill. And we felt that money was needed then for this, for the dental loan forgiveness to be included in the current program. We were trying to cover both the bases that they were covering.
And Senator Bergman, the House had agreed with now, at the time when we did that originally, we didn't have all the specifics laid out exactly what the wording would be and how the priorities for the areas, but in concept we agreed. So as far as I'm concerned, I think we have agreement. We'll have to go through and adopt the right amendments and so forth, but that's all I wanted to confirm at this point. From the House point of view, we've accepted your proposal. I just want to be sure from your point of view if you're satisfied that this item is closed for now.
Mr. Chairman, we do have a different scholarship amendment. In talking with the Board of Nursing, we tweaked it a little bit, and as I was saying, we believe that it is part of this, and so
is that something that you have that we could
yes,
distribute now?
Yes.
Okay, why don't we do that now? Sure.
It's a A52 amendment.
Yeah, loan forgiven. I thought we needed to put a little more time into this.
So just in the interest of time here, I'm not going to go over the whole thing again, just highlight what the differences are. And first of all, the word nursing has been added on page 1, line 14, that was inadvertently omitted on the previous amendment. And then we've reduced the amounts in the rider language for each, for some of the years to leave the Board of Nursing with a surplus of $500,000 so that they have a little bit more comfortable cushion left in their fund. Just technical, the amounts are transferred to the general fund and then appropriated to DHS, and this solves our problem of having to try to appropriate amounts on the administrative part that would be matched with federal dollars. And then at the a very legitimate request of the Board of Nursing is at the end of each biennium, any unspent funds would be transferred back into their special revenue funds so that they're not losing money to the general fund that isn't spent on this purpose. So those are the changes.
This would replace then the A51?
Yes.
Correct? Okay. All right. I think we can follow up. Now, what that means then is that this would apply to that first section, the Senate 13 to 16, as well probably of the that's within that. Yes, yeah, so that section.
Right. Then what we can accomplish here is we can move the dental program into the current loan forgiveness program, repeal the language that was in the higher ed bill because we've taken care of those concerns with the other things we're doing here, and that would add money then to the loan forgiveness program to cover the new activity for dentists that would be coming into the fund.
And Senator Bergman, I had received previously a spreadsheet which was probably based on the old, previous amendment.
Yeah, it's the old numbers. We have a new one.
Okay. I just wanted to be sure that the House had all the right information, so as we go through and consider this, we are properly informed. So this spreadsheet that is dated 6/16/2005 would be to the A52 amendment then.
Yes.
Now, just as a matter of a little bit of side discussion, I think some of us would feel, and I don't know that this has been specifically spoken to, but it would seem to me at any rate that the fee reduction line, because you've actually included rightfully so in your spreadsheet, other proposals, that might be questionable as to whether or not we can afford. Now, I haven't looked enough at the bottom line. But
that is not included in our offer to you. What we have offered to you is to let the Board of Nursing hire some more staff that they believe they need.
I'm just looking at the spreadsheet, so that is a line item on that spreadsheet that would be probably subject to some question. Okay, well, I think we now have an inventory for that. Then there's another item which proposed including the pharmacists into the a loan forgiveness. The Senate, I think, suggested that that should be done if there's additional revenue by using some of the money from it. We had countered with that we think that if everything was right and the right balance was made, that we wouldn't necessarily have to do the additional revenue. And what's the status on that reaction to that?
Mr. Chairman, perhaps you could just discuss that with us a little bit, because our understanding is that if we're adding these new professions into the loan forgiveness program without adding more money, that there will be stress then on the professions that are currently in that loan forgiveness program. The rural physicians and others will not have as many slots then. And We understand that there might be a little bit of concern about the money in the special revenue account from the Board of Pharmacy, but it does work itself out in the years 09 and 08 and 09. So we felt, and the board testified in front of my division, that they could afford to fund this for the on a permanent basis. They testified both in regard to the Rural Pharmacy Grant Program and the Loan Forgiveness Program, that they supported those and they could fund those. So
you're suggesting that the Board of Pharmacy was okay with the taking money from their special revenue account to help cover this loan forgiveness?
Yes.
It would appear by the balance sheet that I have on the Board of Pharmacy that they're actually running in a current. Now, I don't call. Well, this did include the loan forgiveness, but it appeared as though they were in 09, they were actually about $1 million in structural deficit.
Maybe I could ask Mr. Godfrey to speak to that issue.
Mr. Chair, members, looking at the accumulated ending balance in fiscal year 09, there is a deficit there of just a little over $1 million. However, I was told by representative from the Department of Finance that the situation for 10 and 11 are expected to be dramatically improved. I mean, would continue to improve. I mean, their situation would be that their structural surplus, once all of these programs have been sunsetted as called for in the Senate bill, that by the end of fiscal year 11, they'd be back in surplus again. Perhaps somebody from the Department of Finance could speak to that.
Is there somebody who can speak to that? In fact, I think I misspoke. It was $1 million in the hole as a net balance, not as a structural. The structural was about $400,000 structural loss per year. Well, in 07, 08, and 09, all of those had. But the accumulated, which would be, I don't know how you pay your bills when you have $1 million in the hole. So I don't see anybody coming forward, so we may have to follow up on that. But that would be concern of the House is that we seem to have already from the Board of Pharmacy a pretty tough situation financially, and even if it did improve in 2010, I don't know how you get there if you're in the hole. So we'll follow up with that. The latest, I think, spread that you have continues, and we suggested in the case of the Center of Excellence for Nursing that having just a $500,000 one time seems suspicious, and we're anxious to be sure that there's no hidden obligations and that in fact we actually budget for out of this and then see how the balance is. There's two problems with that. One is we don't have numbers to say what will the ongoing be, and I know there were indications from the Nurses Association that they would find other ways. I think it'd be helpful to the House if we had good numbers and we actually plugged it in so that we had some assurance that we wouldn't be back in a year or two from now asking for some sort of general fund support. These initiatives seem to be supported by these groups and seem to be willing to fund, but when I don't see money there for ongoing, I get nervous. So I would just sort of serve notice at this point that we do need some numbers. For that, I think I have mentioned that to some of the Nurses Association people, so that would be a follow-up item that we would need. And then, the other one, I believe, and Senator Boomer, if I'm right, on the Article 2, Section 27, the rate increase, that's all part of this amendment as well. Is that correct?
Right.
Okay.
The A52 amendment would be the language that we would be looking for that item.
Okay, so we have some follow-up work to do. On the next page, the House does have, on the unborn child pain prevention, there was a piece of work done with the cooperation of the Medical Association. Then there was an amendment, BL $11.55 that was offered, and I believe there's been a group that's done some work to try to combine as best possible another amendment, and I don't know what the number is, but we have another amendment now that we could distribute? Or is it already been distributed? I'm sorry. And that amendment is?
Where is it?
It's the 112.
Person Wilkin, can you identify what amendment that is?
Yeah, that's the A-112 amendment. Yeah. I believe that was sitting at members' chairs when we came in. Or the third.
Want to look at mine?
Sure, I may have to. It's around somewhere. Right. Okay. Person Wilkin, would you explain the amendment to members?
After there's been iterations going back and forth with the wording with offers from the Senate and work with the MMA, what this does is it settles on a 20-week, which is, I believe, consistent with the Right to Know website. It does take language from the Senate offer that talked about disclosure of cost and if the woman consents. It adds that language in. And is there a, I think that there is another change. But I think that's basically the gist of the changes. One paragraph is in a little different position than we originally offered. That was an error on my part in talking with House Research when we originally drafted the language that was a compromise from the original House position.
I think, Senator Berglund, we would offer that for consideration instead of having a chance to take a look at it and decide.
We'll take a look at it.
Yeah. I think we're at a point where we feel we've probably gone just about as far as we can on the issue and maintaining some integrity of the issue. On the other part of that was the performance reporting system. I just want to make sure, Senator Berglund, that we're correct. We already adopted the A-20. And there's a technical amendment, A-40. Does that bring it up to date, then, with the language that the Senate wishes for the performance reporting system proposal?
Yes.
Okay. Good. All right. So we'll follow up with that. Then we had a number of items which the Senate did not include, which I assume that we're not accepting at this point. But we had, I think, about three items that we had tagged as kind of program integrity, eligibility verification, and so forth. So those would still be around for consideration.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
Right here. If I could just interject here, I guess, and I hope this is not a line, but I'm going to say it anyway. I guess I see no reason, like on the special transportation, and if you flip over to the next page on the prior authorization on chiropractic visits, I don't know why we can't get that figured out today. I guess, you know, I'm asking, you know, Representative Powell and Representative Ablers, you know, who I know would like to, you know, we don't want the prior authorization on the chiropractors, I don't believe, and I think that, you know, in accepting the Senate's language on the special transportation, all we're doing is just saying that we're not going to have just holding off for a year. I don't think there's anything wrong with that. I mean, what if we just can we just talk about that instead of just waiting? Or
Senator Coyne, we're prepared to talk to her. We just haven't quite gotten there yet, so
okay.
We're ready to get there. And why don't we go ahead on the special transportation? I think the status there, and I believe there's been some really good work trying to accommodate. I think this is. This has been a sticky issue, would probably be an underestimation, an understatement from parties of all sides. And maybe Representative Powell and Senator Patton Solon could sort of give us. I think we are close. There is no, at least in my estimation, there is no answer that doesn't have some kind of consequences and somebody doesn't like it. I mean, that's...
Yeah.
Mr. Chairman, if I could just ask my distinguished chairwoman if that, if, hope you're not mad at me or anything. I'm just wondering if we can't just trade one for the other. I mean, and then get it done with. I mean, that's my suggestion. I mean, go with the Senate language on the transportation and go with what Representative Ablers has on the prior authorization. There's an offer.
Well, Senator Cornyn, why don't we respect the work that's been going on?
I think
Representative Powell and Senator Sullivan have done some good work. So could you just kind of update the committee on what your thoughts and recommendations might be? And Senator Sullivan, if you'd like to begin.
Sure, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Representative Paul and I have met on a couple of occasions for prolonged periods of time to discuss this, and it is a sticky issue. And Representative Paul has come up with an amendment that seems agreeable, but it doesn't, at this point, complete the negotiations that we've been looking at. And we are so close, but we still have a little work to do at this point. I don't know if Representative Paul wishes to elaborate on that at this point, or
President Paul?
No,
Mr. Chairman, I think Senator Prentice-Sonal puts it quite succinctly. We have a little bit of work to do yet. It is a very contentious, sticky issue in which no matter which way we fall, it's not going to be a perfect solution, certainly. So I believe that I've gotten a couple calls into DHS. I want to check a couple things with them, and I'd expected to contact you the next couple days. So I think it's a bit premature for us to make a decision on that today.
Mr. Chair, I think that also that there's still some information that isn't clear that we have to clarify, and perhaps that's what Representative Paul is looking for too. And so we've been perhaps operating under some misperceptions about things, and need to make sure that we're using the right facts here.
You both means are non-diplomatic. Senator Bergen.
I'm being blunt. I'm sorry about that.
Well, Mr. Chairman, it was just really such a treat to be able to be in my district on Tuesday. So I just wanted to say that to folks. I had the opportunity to go to visit the seniors that reside in the Ebenezer Park Apartments. They were celebrating their 25th anniversary of the building being constructed. And I was sitting there and, you know, having a little piece of watermelon with them, and lady at the table was telling me about the difficulty she's having getting special transportation. She is in a wheelchair, and she finally has resorted to going on to a waiver slot so that she can get her transportation. And I was just amazed. I mean, she is not in a nursing home. She obviously is in a wheelchair. I mean, I saw her sitting in the wheelchair. I saw them wheel her out from the building. And she's using a waiver slot that probably should be, with our limited waiver slots, used by somebody else because of this problem that's been created with this special transportation system. So I thought I'd just share that for whatever it's worth for all of you who are looking forward to having this new system in your cities and districts as well.
Senator Hottinger?
Mr. Chairman, a question for Representative Powell. Would you characterize your discussions as being this close?
Representative Powell.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Hottinger, yes, I would, as a matter of fact.
Well, that's good to know. Thank
you. Well, Representative Cornyn, I'm as anxious as you are to bring this to conclusion, absolutely. And I mean, I hope we can just evaluate on this good policy or not and the right thing to do. I mean, I think that's exactly what our two...
And all I was trying to do is make a, you know, just say, you know, if we gave a little, you know, you could give a little. And that's what it has to be. I don't know.
Senator Cornyn, I don't sense that at least this is a kind of a rigid House position versus a rigid Senate position. I think this is... trying to work through a very difficult issue in the most constructive way. Anecdotally, I can hear stories lots of different kinds of ways. On a global level, I can look at it and say it makes a lot of sense to move this kind of direction. that you can improve service in most respects. Now, maybe you're going to have exceptions. On a cost point of view, it can benefit, but we're clearly not ready to spread this thing statewide.
And Mr. Chairman, I agree with you wholeheartedly, and I just, you know, I'm just saying, you know, just waiting 12 months, you know, to see if, you know, what changes in 12 months. And so that's all I'm saying on the transportation issues.
Well, my hunch is, and our hardworking group here hasn't been very specific, but my hunch is we're probably moving.
There's a reason for that.
Yeah, there's a reason for that. So I don't want to violate their confidences. So
I suggest we move on.
Yes, absolutely. Good idea. The next item is Addenda Rule 101, and I believe that we have a suggestion, an amendment from the department. That was Amendment 104, and that, again, should have been your packet. And I, this came from the department, was an idea? And I believe that this may have come from the Department of Human Services. That is an idea to at least give to us. So if there's someone here that could just sort of explain, I think the technically what it is fairly straightforward, but maybe just a little accompanying logic as to make this, because what it changes is the 10% requirement to just having public assisted patients, if I understand the gist of the proposal. So, welcome to the committee.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, Sheriff Sadlack, Department of Human Services. Now, what this would do is, instead of removing dental providers completely from 101, it would give them several options. One would be that they could accept new clients that are on our programs. And two, if they already have clients on our program, they'd also be qualified. So it's either new or current, but the current doesn't have to be up to the 10% threshold. So that would be the difference.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Berglund.
Mr. Chairman, so if you're serving one patient, would you qualify?
That's correct. Right.
Okay.
Very straightforward. Thank you.
Is that, I agree, okay? Or?
No, I don't think so.
Oh, we got that one settled.
We're this close, Mr. Chair.
Missed it by that much.
We're percentage points away from resolution.
And then continuing that same page, the Medicare eligibility is another program integrity being kind of incorporated in that cluster of three items, which is also the first item on the next page. On the prior authorization, I believe, just to confirm our status, that we had an amendment A22. It's already been adopted. There is another A26, which I think is just technical. So our current status in terms of the difference of opinion rests on the subject of chiropractic visits. And I don't think that we need to re-enter the argument because I think Representative Weber presented his case. I'm not prepared at this point. I think it's just wanted to make sure as we perhaps recess or we decide what we're going to take as a next step that we have the right status.
I do have another handout for people if they want to read over the It appears that there's people could use some. I won't make a big point about it, but I'll pass it out. And then
would you raise your hands? Why don't we make it available? If people want it, they can certainly have that. The other final item on program integrity is the waiver request. Then moving into Senate Article 4, the ICFMR.
It says you've got marked.
That means that's been finished. We've already accepted it. I just shaded it just because it was in our proposal.
I didn't think we did accept it.
Yeah, what we agreed to do is drop it. I'm sorry. I should have been more clear. The House has agreed to drop it.
It's a little confusing.
Right. Yeah.
All right.
I mean, what I mean by the Senate did not accept, the accept should say, but if you make note, what I mean is that the House has dropped the proposal.
All right.
Which one?
This
one.
We're accepting a drop.
Yes. You figure out this logic, tell me about it. I think Boolean algebra is easier. Okay, on the ICFMR, it's not so much ICFMR, it's the other, which is identifying employers. whose employees are enrolled, and we have an amendment from the Senate, I think, that brings it up to the level it would be considered, and that's the A9 amendment. Is that correct? Is that the current status of that proposal?
There is an amendment which is more along the lines of a technical amendment, but we did get a memo from the Department of Human Services saying that this one-time report would be $40,000 and would not be contingent upon health match implementation. So the amendment doesn't affect the fiscal note. So we just wanted to make sure you understood that tracking on the Senate side is too high, and it does fall within the 50,000 criteria that you had set.
So just to be sure, because our tracking had shown 200,000, what happened to change it to 40,000? There's no language change. Mr. Godfrey, can you explain?
I'd like to speak to that.
Yes, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. The original tracking showed a cost of $216,000, and that amount was based on an estimate from a previous fiscal note that we had that had assumed that the report would be an ongoing report. And after we changed the concept from an ongoing report to a one-time report, we then asked, I think, DHS to look at that cost again, and they determined that the one-time report actually would cost significantly less from the 216 and put the price at $40,000.
And so we just hadn't gotten a response from them to update our tracking.
And Senator Bergman, I, not having gone back and reviewed the language, then is the language clear in saying that it's just a one-time report requirement?
Yes.
Okay. Okay. Now we understand what that one is.
And there is a technical amendment that's been requested for that section. It's the
that
A9.
That we have?
Right. Has everyone got it?
Yes.
A9. Oh, yeah. Oh, the A-9?
Okay.
Okay.
All
yep.
right.
So we have that in hand. Good. And then on to the next and final page. I believe we understand the Senate proposed an amendment which made it clear that, make sure again that this is our current status, the A46 amendment that the Senate proposed would indicate clearly that this would only occur after there had been a fair bid, and I'm somewhat paraphrasing, but I think that was sort of the gist of the amendment.
Right.
Okay, and that is the correct status, and that response, okay. On the absent day limit, we have the Senate's final position, our last position was that it would accept the House only if we adopted the A12 amendment, and I think that is a status. Now, we are trying to get fiscal notes. It does appear as though that A12 amendment has a fairly significant impact on the fiscal note, but we're working on it. But that is the correct status at this point, is the A12. I think the A12 amendment had sort of two provisions. One of them was that the actual counting for absent days would not include days that were excused by a medical reason, and the other was that a medical reason wasn't required if a person was uninsured. I think those are the nature of the two proposals.
Yes.
Okay. Then we have a section on H10 and another one that deal with the new residents, I think, that the House had just asked. And I assume by the absence in the Senate's proposal that the Senate was not indicating an exception unless there's a new one. Is it fair to assume at this point that the Senate, I guess what it would really say is that the next three, really, that the Senate has not accepted those three?
That's correct.
Okay. And then Senator Hottinger had a combined amendment on child care reporting that the status still remains the same on that. And that's, now for some reason I'm indicating two amendments. Were there two separate amendments on that, was there? Senator Hottinger?
Mr. Chairman, that's a mistake. It's just the A11 amendment.
Just the A11 amendment only? Okay. Thank you. And then finally, in Article 7, we had, this is where we had the drug manufacturers to report on pricing criteria. We had, actually, I don't think this, yeah, I'm sorry, there it is, the Senate Amendment A47 that Senator Solon had presented to us. Now, I don't know what your situation, Senator Solon. I've had some contact from people saying that it doesn't quite yet match sort of the federal or some other questions about what is reported beyond that, but just on the what is reported.
Excuse me, Mr. Chairman, could we go back a minute?
Yes, I'm sorry.
On the Child Care Amendment, which was a proposal to meld the two House studies, it says A11 and A13. A13 was actually an amendment to the absentee limits, and it was to have a different startup date for January 2007 when the computer capability in the Child Care Administration would be would more easily manage that position if we did it. So
I'm sorry, and is that still should be included on the absentee limit?
Unless there was a discussion in my absence at the last meeting.
There was not. No.
Then it should
for some
be
reason
included.
It was missing in that counter list that I saw.
Okay, so then it should be included with the H3 provision.
Thank you. Got it. Thank you.
It is listed under absentee. A12 and A13 are both listed under absentee.
It was originally, but then when the Senate came back, it wasn't included. That's why I got confused. All right, I'm sorry, Senator Solon, is there any continuing action on your proposal, A47?
Well, Mr. Chair, I did hear that, I did hear some complaints about that, but my belief is that the Texas bill asks for the AMP and the best price, and that's what the federal government requires also, the AMP and the best price, and that is what was pared down to in the language of that the amendment that
my
was
only
read
purpose,
in last week.
Excuse me, I'm sorry. My only purpose here was just to confirm. I didn't want to, if this represents your stand in the A47, that's all we need for this moment. We may have a few ins about it, but for now I just want to be sure we were doing the right thing.
Okay.
Got it. Okay. And as I said, I did take the prerogative. I think I had sort of indicated this, Sandra Bergman. Those remaining three sections in which we've had sort of back and forth, the House is agreeing with the Senate position that what we should do is consider that a part of the actual budget considerations. I believe the Senate had general fund coverage. We were suggesting a different way. Whatever the final conclusion would be, we agree with you that we remove this from the policy considerations and that would be withheld when we get into the budget. So that's why that's shaded. And I believe that completes an inventory. Now, as I see it, my hope would be, because I think we're prepared as a House now to take this and sort of try to digest and come back with sort of a serious and I hope virtually concluding kind of suggestions. I'm a little bit uncertain, though, because I think we have at least 2 or 3 hours of work to do that right. And although I'd be potentially open to that, I mean, one possibility would be that we recess and come back here, perhaps 5-ish or something. Another possibility, and I don't sense anything that would say that that we have to be pressed that hard, even though I'm anxious to get it done. But we could respect our families and other things and suggest that we bring it back to you on Monday. We won't be able to meet tomorrow. The House will not be able to meet tomorrow. I should have mentioned that before. But I think that would be our choices. Either if we want to try to press on, and I can't promise that we get all done because there are a few places where we have to get some information from people. And I also wonder, Representative Powell, this might help a little bit. I believe you said in terms of timeline on the transportation that you might be talking about a day or two. And it would really be nice to come back and to conclude all of this and including that particular item. Otherwise, we're kind of coming back together and then leaving something open. So given the fact, because I think we've got an awful lot of things here we can bring conclusion to. Senator Bergman?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I would prefer if we came back on Monday rather than taking a three-hour recess.
I think that's fair.
And we were not planning on meeting tomorrow either, so I think it would be probably a more productive use of our time if we decided to schedule around our session times on Monday.
Sure. Well, good. I think that's a fair. Senator Hottinger?
Mr. Chairman, whatever you want in coming back, I just wanted to raise one issue that had been brought to my attention that might or might not, depend on whether the committee believes we've resolved this, be added, and that's the Hospital Association has suggested that in Section 9 of Senate Article 7, which deals with medical assistance payment for prisoners, they didn't... I don't know if it was resolved when the A6 amendment to that section was adopted. They believe it's necessary to have some language indicating that if the prisoner is brought in, the county is responsible for paying for it. Now, that may be resolved. The committee may have determined that resolved, but they don't believe it was resolved.
Senator Hartner, I believe, to be honest and fair, that that issue was not resolved. My own personal read on that, having been somewhat in the middle of that on other occasions, is that... That sort of raises a kind of a new issue that ought to be tracked with a bill, hearings, discussion, those kinds of things. It's a legitimate issue, but there's more than one side to it. And my advice would be, you could argue either way, I suppose, is whether or not this working group, we probably certainly could bring it in. But I'm open to suggestion. But my advice back to those who had talked to me was that we got plenty on our plate. That's a pretty controversial issue. Why don't you do it at another day with a bill that takes a full course?
And Mr. Chairman, I understand that is not a proposal that would go without complaint.
Senator Berglund.
Well, and Mr. Chairman, all of the different years that we've talked about this, no one has ever suggested that the counties aren't paying. So this is a new suggestion that I have never heard of before. I mean, obviously a hospital doesn't have to be in a contract with a county if they don't choose to be to provide prisoner services. So if you're not paying your bill, I would think a hospital would say, well, we're not going to renew a contract with you. So
yeah, allegedly, I think it's a little bit different twist on it. It's sort of where somebody is in another place, is at least the way it's been somewhat characterized to me, and they just drop into the hospital, and it's not a local county with a contract. Senator Hottinger, is that more the likely issue?
I believe that's the case, although I haven't had a chance to explore
that.
That's
why I think it's better to wait. I'm sorry, Senator Bergman.
Mr. Chairman, when people are in jails, they don't just drop in someplace.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Powell.
One wouldn't think so, Senator, but apparently I've been given several examples of how a hospital will find that a deputy has entered their emergency room with a person in custody from a county that they don't have a contract with. They treat the prisoner, whether on an outpatient basis or on an inpatient basis, they release them and the bill does not get paid.
Well,
and that's just basically been the hospital's position on this, that this is, they're getting stuck with bills with counties that they don't have contracts with.
Senator Bergman?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Powell, can I ask you if these are in the nature of 42-hour holds, or are these actual prisoners?
Representative Powell?
I think it kind of runs the gamut. People in custody, I believe, would be a more exact term. Somebody that is in custody of the police for one reason or another that show up at the emergency department.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Bergman.
And Representative Powell, I have heard of the issue of 42-hour holds. Those people are not prisoners. And we do have a bill in the Senate, which we will be giving hearings to this summer, But it is, as Representative Bradley indicated, a pretty complicated issue. My understanding is that the counties do pay when there actually is a commitment, but the hospitals are asking for the 42-hour hold for anybody that's brought there, whether or not they actually are a danger that would warrant a commitment. So I think it really takes a lot more discussion and, you know, kind of trying to unpeel the layers of the onion here before we would take that issue on.
Let the record show that the co-chairs have given similar advice. Any further discussion on the matters before us for today? Seeing none, I think then, and Senator Bergen, if we may, I know that our session is at 2 o'clock on Monday, and it is helpful if we can wait until after session to have our meeting. I'm open to the gavel question, I mean, the 24-hour, but if you want to, I don't care.
It doesn't matter. I think I would be having it tomorrow, and we've agreed not to meet tomorrow, so
60%. Okay. Well, then let's plan on 3 o'clock or following session on Monday that we will meet here. With that, we're going to be adjourned, but I wish you all a great weekend, and the weather is just as I planned it for you.